Hey everybody, we're back with another Commission the Bald Move podcast. This one's for the 1992 flick Glengarry Glen Ross. Bald Move listener Eric Cunanan, I think is how you pronounce that.
It's a good name. I like that.
Cunanan. It's got a nice round woody kind of sound to it. Very pleasant to the palate.
Yeah.
But he wanted us to watch this and comment on it. I'll let him take it away and then we'll get to talking about it. I'd love to hear you discuss 1992 drama Glengarry Glen Ross. I remember when I first watched this movie being simultaneously perplexed and intrigued. Until then, my idea of movies were guns, explosions, nudity, gratuitous sex, and plenty of coarse dialogue. Nothing wrong with that. I remember watching GGR thinking, I don't have the first clue what they're talking about, but how they're talking, the rhythm of which the dialogue danced on the screen. It absolutely pulled me in. The movie manages to touch on so many themes that would be relevant to any generation. Capitalism, male pride, friendship through deception, loyalty, and good old-fashioned ruthlessness. Being so young at the time, I had no idea the weight of screen legends before me. Holy cow, Pacino, Lemon, Harris, Spacey, Baldwin, Alda, holy shit. Finally, I'd be remiss if I did not mention Alec Baldwin's ball-busting scene where he berates all these grown men and simply walks out of the room. I have this speech memorized backwards and forwards and find myself reciting it to myself when I'm shoveling snow or washing dishes. For me, this is one of the all-time...
Always be shoveling? What?
Always be shoveling. Always be clearing cleaning? Snow.
Yeah.
For me, this is one of the all-time, this is my scene, get the fuck out of my way moments in film, and I loved it. Can't wait to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work. So, this is one of those movies I've never seen before, but I felt like I've seen it because I've seen this Alec Baldwin scene so many times.
Right.
I've seen it parodied. Like, there's a, my favorite one is a Saturday Night Live skit
yep.
where John Goodman is an elf. He's there to put Santa's workshop in order.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just
it's Alec Baldwin himself.
Wait, I thought it was John Goodman.
No, Alec Baldwin does that.
Oh,
they had Alec Baldwin on and he revised.
Oh wow,
he reprised his role.
Because so I've seen John Goodman do a version of this too. But
okay,
that makes it even better. And it's just, you know, it. This scene...
It's always be cobbling.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And what is it? The golden tools or something that makes...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, this hammer's for...
closers only.
Yeah, you should check it out. It's pretty funny.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I don't... It's let's talk about the bones of this thing first. This thing was directed by James Foley. It was adapted from a screenplay by David Mamet. Who won a Pulitzer Prize for the stage play version of this.
Right.
And yeah. I'm not going to pretend like I know what the hell David Mamet is all about. I know that he has done a lot of different stuff. The one thing I've seen is this Phil Spector drama that was HBO that also starred a much older Al Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
James Foley, I've seen The Chamber, which is a John Grisham with Chris O'Donnell and I think Gene Hackman.
Hmm.
The Chamber, The Corrupter. You've probably seen that. Chow Yun-Fat and Marky Mark Wahlberg. It's like one of those buddy cop kung fu movies that was popular in late 90s, early aughts.
There are so many of them.
Sure.
I can't remember.
And somehow he's found himself in the hell of directing the sequels to Fifty Shades of Grey, Fifty Shades Darker and Fifty Shades Free. I hope the paycheck is big.
Starring
you never
Al
have to
Pacino.
Work again there, James. But the cast, like, that's the other thing that I thought was super fucking crazy. Al Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
And so this era of Al Pacino is interesting because I read an interview with him contemporaneous of this movie being released, and he's talking about being in what's the one where he's the blind Marine lieutenant colonel? That's not Scent of a Woman, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
The hoo-ha? Sure.
That's where the modern Pacino is cemented, and he's never gotten out of that since, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But he's almost there. He's in full-blown... You know, Kate and Michael debating her having the abortion.
Uh-huh.
You can't take my kids, Kate! I'm not going to allow... I mean, he's in that pretty much the whole movie when he's not doing this, like, crazy long monologue-driven pitch session with this guy who is the High Sparrow from Game of Thrones.
Right. I can't believe how many famous faces are in this, aside from
Jonathan
the main
Price,
cast.
That's his name. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got Jack Lemmon.
Uh-huh.
Who I'm shamefully not that super familiar with. I've seen some Like It Hot. I've seen Grumpy Old Men. So I don't have a lot of depth, but I mean, he's a screen legend. Ed Harris, which is funny because we just got done with his premiere of Westworld where he crushes it, and he's so much younger and so much more intense in this movie.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he's much more intense.
He's much
pretty
younger.
Fucking intense as the Man in Black.
Yeah.
Alec Baldwin, just walk in, mic drop. One of the Alda brothers.
Alan Arkin?
Is Alan Arkin?
I think it's Alan.
I think he went Alda, and I think he's going as a different actor. But yeah, like,
it is. It's Alan Arkin.
Yeah, thank you. So not Alan Alda.
No.
Easy. That's an Aaron mistake. I can't hate anybody.
Alda's the guy from MASH, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So the star wattage on the screen was impressive. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, it wasn't like these were undiscovered talents.
You haven't even mentioned another huge one.
Who?
Kevin Spacey.
Fuck, Kevin Spacey.
Holy shit. I mean, this is one of the greatest casts I've ever seen.
Yes.
And their performances again, are insane.
And sometimes you see this when people like are not quite discovered yet. Like, you know, it's like early on, it's like, oh shit, look at all this talent that they got and they threw together.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this was these
half
people,
of these guys right. are stars already.
And I think it's because the attraction of playing, like, it seems like David Mamet has his legendary reputation among actors as being like, this is the stuff that you want. This is the meaty stuff. This is the dialogue and emotional and character driven stuff that you just can really throw yourself into as an actor. And indeed, as I was watching this movie, I felt like I was watching just an endless Oscar reel.
Yeah.
Like, you know, every single moment of dialogue could have been the thing that an actor was being nominated for, and like the 15-second snip they play before they cut to their face when everybody claps, you know?
Yeah.
It's an hour and a half of just nothing but Oscar acceptance clips.
I think the only person who really doesn't get enough to do, well, I think there are a couple of them. I think Alan Arkin doesn't have quite as significant of a role to play.
Oh, I disagree. I think it's not as showy, but the generosity required to be, like, essentially he is the setup for several other characters. He's playing
right.
the self, he's playing
That's what
the
I mean. He's
boy.
Not going to win an award for this role.
That's true, and I think, but it's a shame because what he's doing is very generous and difficult work.
Right, right. I don't want to belittle Alan Arkin. He's
right.
He's in full Alan Arkin
he's,
mode
he's
here.
He's the
though.
Long snapper but, of the football team.
Right.
Like, you know, he's a vital role, but like, you know, he's never going to make the Pro Bowl and sure.
Yeah, not get MVP for sure.
Yep.
But then I feel like Kevin Spacey is borderline in this, like his role being big enough to really impress people, because all he does most of the time is just stand there and take it.
Yeah. And by the way, we're about to get spoilery, so I mean, this is one of the greatest act, like if
yeah.
there's not much to recommend this other than dialogue and acting, because it's kind of like a bottle movie if the movie was contained in two bottles, I guess.
Okay, right.
You know, the Chinese restaurant and then the actual office.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess a very wet car interior is the third mini bottle.
That car interior is so wet.
But if you like acting tour de forces and you want to see, like, just a really absorbing dialogue, watch this movie if you haven't. I think, and that's the other thing, is I guess I was expecting this to be like a 3-hour movie. Mm-hmm. It's very tight.
Yeah,
it's like 90 minutes, maybe 100 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're about to get spoilery. I thought, I agree with you that Kevin Spacey flirted with being criminally underused, but I felt like at the end of the movie, when you find the double triple twist,
uh-huh.
that he kind of found a corner of the movie to make his own. That's slowly turning the tables on Jack Lemmon.
Okay, let me ask you this real quick, because
okay.
I know I'm going to compare this for a second to one of Kevin Spacey's other movies, which has a big twist at the end.
Okay.
What is the name of
which
that?
Which one? There's The Usual Suspects.
The Usual Suspects.
There's seven.
The Usual Suspects.
Usual horseshits, but Suspects, yes.
Right. So you hate the twist in that.
I do.
Because you can't see it coming.
I think
it's
undeserved
out of the blue.
And unfair.
Right. How'd you feel about the twist in this one? Because there really is no indication that Ed Harris ever talked to Jack Lemmon the previous night.
But they talk about what a big mouth. I mean, I guess what we know about the characters and how they interact, that space, like that there's that exists in the negative space in the movie where that possibility, and the fact that Jack Lemmon did it to himself in his own hubris.
right.
made that twist, because it wasn't about the twist so much as it was about here Jack Lemmon, who is this guy in the twilight of his career, used to be a big thing, has fallen on hard times, deludes himself into thinking he's got to win when he doesn't, mm-hmm. and just runs with all, and he thinks he's got this Kevin Spacey character in a one down position, someone who's been his kind of tormentor, this bean counter, like, you know, guy doesn't yeah. understand sales. And then he gets he plays out enough rope to hang himself. And I mean, there's not really heroes or villains in this movie, but I guess Jack Lemmon is, I mean, all these guys are villains. Every one yeah. of these guys are Absolutely. Essentially less successful versions of the Leonardo DiCaprio character from The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. They're trying. So. They're all shysters, right?
They're trying to scam. I mean, like, I just wonder, like, what would these guys do if they had a product that people wanted to buy? You know, and
be successful.
And that's the thing. Like, truly great salesmen, like the Alec Baldwin character, and even I thought that the Roma character, the Rick Roma that played by Al Pacino, he seems yep. like he was successful. They can sell anything because. Yeah. They're very likable and charismatic and like in a cult leader kind of way. And you are willing to part with huge sums of money and do risky things because you want their approval. You want to be this guy.
Right. And I mean, think Al Pacino in this movie, Roma, understands that the best of all.
Sure.
Because he doesn't the reason he's so effective is he doesn't feel desperate. He doesn't feel like he's trying to really sell you on anything. He's yes. more bringing you into his aura
right.
and then allowing the sale to happen.
Yes.
And I think it's so much more effective than what you see Jack Lemmon doing, who is desperate.
And it's funny because as he gets more and more desperate, he retreats further and further from the sale.
Right.
Like, let's just put it off on the table. Let's talk about, I'm worried about you, you know? That's great. But this is everything that I don't like about sales.
Right. It's all sleazy. It's all.
It doesn't have to be, though, because sure. like Ed Harris has this thing about, like, you know, you don't want to sell one car, you want to sell 14.
Mm-hmm.
Like you give a person a good deal and a good sales experience, and they're going to come back because it's so rare to find that.
Yeah.
It seems like that is the way to go, but it seems like there's also the school of thought in sales that you have to be this kind of shyster, liar. Pump yourself up, make yourself look more important than you do, and it works, but...
Well, it's the easy cash-in, and I think like yeah. that's what Ed Harris's point is in the movie, is, you know, you can take the long term, and, sure. and you can say, I'm going to sell this guy 14 cars over 20 years,
mm-hmm.
versus I'm going to sell him one car that's real expensive right now, and just
right.
and just cash out.
Right.
And he made the point that, like, once enough people start doing that, the salesman gets the reputation, and they spoil it for everyone.
You right.
know? Even the honest salesman can no longer make a sale because everyone views them as shysters.
But it's funny because this is... I mean, there's... I've got two minds of almost everything in this movie because I do think that sales is very hard. I can't do yeah. it. I've tried to do it.
Would
I've
it
done...
surprise you to know that my dad was a salesman for a very long
Not
time?
Not at all. Not at all. Because your dad yeah. has got the essential qualities of a salesperson. He
right.
is confident. Mm-hmm. Criticism kind of rolls off his back. He's
forceful.
Got the gift of gab.
Right. He can be fairly forceful in his persuasion techniques.
Sure, sure. But... Yeah, I mean, I feel like, but also, I don't know. It's funny because some people are just really bad. Like I've had some experiences. Like there's this my small town insurance agent. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was like 17 or 18, and he was talking about, you know, he's talking about. I was asking him about different things, and my dad had always told me, like, for life insurance, that whole life is a scam. Like, it's you either want an investment vehicle or you want something to protect your earnings capacity. Like, the whole life stuff that is super profitable for insurance agents are, you know, terrible ideas for individuals because it tries to blend both of those and does a terrible job at both. Hmm. And I was talking, and I talked to my insurance agent, and he was saying the same thing. Like, anyone that's trying to sell you whole life is, like, you know... But and is kind of scamming you, and if they're trying to pressure you into that, and, you know, it's like we had a good conversation. I came back 4 years later because at that point I was married and I wanted to get a term life insurance while I was still young, and I went into Dubai but he tried, the same guy tried to sell me whole life and pushed it really hard with all the same lame bullshit that I always do, and I just thought it was like, it felt very Jack Lemmon. I don't know whether he was maybe, I don't know whether he'd fallen on hard times or why he was doing
this.
Car
in the running.
Did Alec Baldwin come in his office and tell him, you son of a bitch, you cocksucker.
He couldn't have any coffee in the morning. He was angry.
Yeah.
He had a headache.
But it's like when you get those really true, or if you've ever been walking down a pier in Florida and one of these guys tries to sell you a timeshare.
Oh, right.
Like, it's just like, oh, no. Oh, I feel so bad for you. But also, they're, you know, it's kind of like they're a fucking Vegas dealer. They're smiling and they're cajoling you, but they're trying to fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, no one in their right mind buys these things in this, like, you know, it's fine to speculate in real estate and invest in it, but I don't think you want to do it as a result of a cold call.
Yeah, right. It's not that nobody in their right mind would buy these things, but if the salesman was being honest with you, he would tell you it's a bad idea.
Right.
Whereas he's going to ignore that fact and try to get you to buy it.
And the other
regardless.
Thing is, I got the impression, and I could be wrong because I'm not a salesperson, but they talk about, you know, these leads. You got these weak leads and you got the Glengarry leads.
Right.
I didn't get the impression that the Glengarry leads were any better that the properties were any better. The thing that the Glengarry leads got going for it is they're brand new.
Like, they're new and they've been background checked, so they're like people who they know have the money,
yeah.
Who can invest,
right?
And the recent,
but also the others are just stepped on, like, yeah. not only have, you know, these people not been vetted, or maybe you're talking about crazy people, or you're going to waste your time with people that don't even have the money, mm-hmm. but they've been called 5-6 times in the last year,
right?
Like, and I think that one time where Jack Lemmon shows up and talks to the guy, and it's just such an uncomfortable scene. Because Jack knows from the second he walks in the door that this isn't going to happen.
Did you recognize that guy?
No. Who is he?
Terry Colby from Mr. Robot.
Oh, shit. Yep. You're right.
Yep.
The last honest man on earth.
Right.
I'll be damned. Damn. Is there anybody in this movie that's not gone on to be some character actor of renown?
I don't think so. Maybe one of the cops?
Yeah. But he even says, you get it from the other perspective. Like, ever since my wife filled out that goddamn survey card, we've been plagued by you people.
Yeah.
It's like if you take a fucking watchtower from a Jehovah's Witness.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. You're going to get a call from them every 2 to 6 weeks until
you
tell them to get the fuck out.
Right.
So that's the thing. It's like, it's not like they even have a better vehicle. It's just like they're all the same scam. It's just, mm-hmm. these guys are rubes. They're freshly washed rubes, and they're sheep that we know haven't been shorn too recently. So they still got their wool. And I just thought that's, I don't know, man. And then the concept of, like,
well, let me ask you about those properties, because but before we get too far from you know, this scam idea. What is your impression of the properties themselves? Like, aside from the tactics used to sell them, do you think the properties are actually valuable, are actually going to make people money?
There's one picture that's really pretty.
Right.
But, like, that brochure was essentially just a fucking poster. There's no guarantee that that's what it looks like. It could be, like, stock imagery. Like,
might be swamp.
I have no idea. So you know, since I've been through some rounds of these types of scams, and it's heartbreaking, because I've also had, like, people that get sucked into this, like, multi-level marketing shit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they have you over for dinner, and your time's like, oh, I haven't heard. That's going to be, oh, yeah, we haven't heard from these guys for a couple years. Let's go over there. And, like, 30 minutes in, it becomes this high-pressure sales pitch for vitamins or Amway. And I'm like, it's so incredibly depressing, because not only is this not going to work for them, but they've essentially ruined their friendship over it.
Right.
And that's, like, I guess they don't understand. Like, yeah, you're pumping your loyalties and friendship out of the ground like it's oil. Mm-hmm. And that shit refreshes like oil in geologic times. Like, I'm not going to, you know, like, that's pretty much, you know, I wasn't ever your best friend anyway, and now, like, our relationship's fucked.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess I did you think that some of the properties were actually better?
No, I mean, I guess there's no context to really tell, right? I mean, from what you see, they might be fine, mm-hmm. But who knows?
I just look at the desperation and the stink and the sleaze, and I think right. that that's not a great product.
Yeah, I imagine. You're probably right.
You know, I mean, there's like, I guess there's two different types of salespersons. The ones that are like cold calling and drumming up interest, and the others that like are selling good products that people are coming to them for interest in. And that's like easy. That's like shooting fish in a barrel. That's when you right. can be like, oh, I'm just looking out for my client's best interest. Well,
then you can be Hank Hill.
Sure.
You can just wait in the store for people to come
to
you.
Sell propane and propane accessories, and you're passionate about that.
He's a good salesman, I'd say. Yeah. An honest salesman.
Do we need... I mean, I guess the big question is, do you need salesmen like this to make the world work? Like, if you have a good product... If you have a good product that fails because it didn't get in front of people, do you need a salesperson, people like this, to like kind of kick your door in? And I think about like last Christmas, I saw this movie Joy, which was about this woman who invented the self-ringing mop, okay? Mm-hmm. And like it seemed like a great product that's been cloned a million times, and it seems like it's like it, but it just wasn't getting traction because she was just a housewife and she had no idea how to sell and market this thing.
Right.
And then she went on to like the, what do you call those, the home shopping networks, and found some success.
Yeah.
I feel that like that's sense. That's like the case of like that's a good product that's just brand new and it needed somebody. It needed like an yeah. Alec Baldwin to go in there and make the right connections. But
well, I mean, it just needs exposure, right? Like that's the thing. To me, this feels sleazy because they are doing the outbound calls to people who probably don't want their stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like maybe they signed up for some thing a long time ago and you know, to get the timeshare stuff, right?
Right.
Like that sort of thing, to get two free vacation days.
Right.
And now they're plagued by it. But like I feel like if you have a good product, the sales will come to you if you can get the word out.
Mm-hmm.
So these people are not getting the word out. That's not what they're here to do. They're here to force a sale where a sale wouldn't have otherwise happened.
Right.
Because they have a product that people don't really want.
And it seems like they're targeting vulnerable people too.
Yeah.
But these aren't, you know, captains of industry. These are mom and pops when you're playing with their children's inheritance and you're flirting with making these people get divorces and stuff and their family finds out that they can't say no. Because that's right. the other thing. Like, I feel like there's some... I don't know what that's like because I have been hoodwinked a few times, but I've also been in these high-pressure deals, and like it gets to a point where I just start laughing.
Uh-huh.
Like, unless you're going to physically restrain me from this room and good fucking luck, I'm leaving, and this is a joke, and you know, this is but there's some people that, like that Jonathan Pryce character, he's apologizing for disappointing Al Pacino at the end.
Right.
Like, and he probably would have been roped back in had it not been Kevin Spacey coming in there and opening his big fat mouth and fucking everything up.
I mean, I guess I can understand the apology because he did promise to do something and now he's reneging on that. So like, that's kind of a thing you
but it's
probably
like promising to
do.
Have sex with someone after you've been roofied. Like, he's using these ruthless psychological techniques to take the thing the evolution provided us for,
sure.
to draw us close and to form communities so that mm-hmm. we're successful. These are evolutionary tactics that are successful, to band together and to share common hardships and common experiences and to bond over that. And he's hijacking that to sell right. bullshit real estate.
Yeah, I'm not excusing that.
Okay.
I'm just saying, like, going back on your word is a thing you should probably apologize
for. And he's also hacking that part of the social contract, because the other thing is right. like, why would you apologize for breaking a promise to a man who's lied to your face?
Sure.
Demonstrably, no. several times.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Like, keeping your promise only is meaningful in some scenario where that social contract about, you know, lying and defrauding is in
yeah.
force, right?
My God, the 3 days thing. Like, when they go on and on about that 3 days thing, I'm just like, Pacino,
do you think this
you know
man,
what you're fucking doing here.
Right.
You know what you're doing.
Yes.
Admit it, you yes. son of a bitch.
Yes. And that's how little he cares about that guy. He
yeah.
just wanted to get to the point where it was too late for this guy to back out, and he's got his money, and there you go.
Right. Can you count to three? Then you know you're trying to fuck me here.
Right. And then he's lying about the deposits and like just all this crazy right. stuff.
Yeah, it really struck me like how much rage is in this movie. And so I guess when David Mamet wrote this, it was meant to be kind of to depict the large and small indignities that the working class have to endure.
Because I read that this was a result of him working in one of these boiler room type things.
He did, yeah.
Who's the guy that did Hank Hill, speaking of Hank Hill and Silicon Valley?
Mike Judge.
Mike Judge wrote... shit, I can't think of the Office Space. He wrote Office Space as a result of his experience being that kind of middle-level programmer. Scott Adams right. created Dilbert after he spent time in cubicle at the Bell telephone companies and like knowing what that, you know, just essential soulless cubicle dwelling experience is like. Like, it seems like your place of employment can have a powerful impact on your creative juices.
For sure. Yeah. So I'm trying to, I guess, understand the rage that I see in this movie because it is visceral and it is from everyone.
Yes, everyone is angry.
Top to bottom. It's middle level management. I mean, maybe the only guy who isn't angry here, I feel, is like Alan Arkin. He doesn't seem particularly angry.
But he's too dumb to be angry.
Right, right.
He's too dumb and easily swayed, so he's going to be the first one on the chopping block.
But everybody, I mean, Alec Baldwin is super successful, but also very angry.
Right.
And I don't know if that's part of his shtick in this movie, or if that's, like, just a thing that, you know, you got to be to get to the top here.
Well, so there's a lot of things that go in that, right? In salesmen, it seems like the successful ones have the right stuff mentality, like from the movie, where...
Yeah.
When something goes wrong, the airplane explodes or whatever, they're not the ones that fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
It's the person being stupid, or they wasted their time, or the middle management, or the leads are weak. And that kind of reactionary lashing out behavior tends to make you, if everyone's a failure except for you,
mm-hmm.
then you're just going to have nothing but contempt for your coworkers and fellow men.
Sure.
That's a recipe for anger.
Yeah.
I also think there's this something, you know, like this concept of toxic masculinity where these guys, I think, isn't it Jack Lemmon who says, like, a man's defined by his job? And if you've got a shitty job where you're defrauding people all day and, you know, these other bastards are having more success than you with the same leads and that's galling and they're screwing up and there's this guy that has never sold a day in his life and he's the one that's the gatekeeper from your success, like... That's something to make you angry too.
Sure.
And there's this whole throughout this, like, I guess Jack Lemmon, I didn't quite understand. I need to see this another time to understand the subplot with his wife and daughter. He's being a shitty family man and he's like Alec Baldwin's the same way. Cause he's like, oh, are you a good father? Fuck you. Like all this stuff, which is pretty funny.
Right.
But at least he's successful. He's got to watch mm-hmm. more than these guys' cars, and like so. It's one thing to sacrifice your family and be a shitty human being and have something to show for it.
Right.
Jack Lemmon's doing that and having nothing to show for it.
Yeah, less than nothing. I mean, he steals these leads. He presumably goes to prison at the end of this movie.
For $5,000.
Yeah. It's not worth it, man. But yeah, anger and desperation seem to be the driving emotions of all of these guys. And I guess, you know, with good reason.
Why do you think Roma is so? Because I read some reviews that implied that Roma was just as unsuccessful as these guys. But I guess I didn't see that. I thought Roma was the one that's always crushing it. And he's maybe going to make the leap up to Alec Baldwin status.
Maybe so. It seems like he has taken the place at the top that Jack Lemmon once had.
Mm-hmm.
That Shelley, what's his name, Levine?
Yeah, Shelley Levine.
Had at one point, because, you know, Shelley goes on and on about how successful he used to be, and for 3 years in a row, I was 8 months out of the year, I was the top on that board, and, you know, he's kind of a has-been now. He's gotten to the point where he's in a slump. He had a few bad months, and that got into his head, and now he's desperate.
I feel like in this universe, 2020 just did some kind of investigative expose about this type of predatory real estate deal, and now, like, all the old people watch that show... And, like, now they're all on guard for that kind of scam.
Well, I think life, it is part of that. Like, Ed Harris says that, right?
Really? Life's moving on, and they've pumped this well dry, and they all probably need to find another line of... They need to find the next scam.
Right. It seems like salesmen who are doing this kind of sales work need to across the board. Because, like Ed Harris says, you know, the Shysters came in, they cashed out, they ran to Belize or wherever the hell they went.
Right.
And now an honest salesman can't make a dollar because everyone views salesmen as shitbags.
I also think part of the interesting thing about this is sales is like one of those things where you don't need any experience to get your foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can literally show up as a result of an ad and start selling steak knives door to door, vacuum sleepers door to door. But the thing is like, that also means that, like, how am I trying to phrase this? Because I've tried to bring this up three different times and I failed every, and I feel like I'm about to fail. There's this point in the movie where Alec Baldwin, in his epic speech, is saying, you know, what are you guys going to, you going to go out there and get hard, or are you going to be one of the failures that's sitting around at a bar telling everybody sales is a tough racket?
Yeah.
It's one of those weird things where, like, if you're playing NFL football, you can't just walk off the street and they're like, yeah, sure, put on pads, we'll get out there and see if you get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be have a demonstrable track record of excellence. Whereas with sales, you can just walk in a door, and a lot of times it's on commission, and like, people don't really care. It's like, okay, well, you'll sink and swim, and it is really tough. You have to be mentally, you don't have to be just talented. You have to be mentally tough.
Yeah. You have to deal with a lot of rejection.
Rejection,
which is
super, like, you know, obviously, a lot of people don't deal real well with.
Right.
And I think that's the other interesting thing about this is that, you know, like, the one guy played by Arkin, was he ever successful? Is he ever going to be successful? Is he one of those guys that's like, I failed in a bunch of different stuff, and there's this want ad, and I could start right away, and there's not too many questions, and he's just going to eventually flame out? Was Jack Lemmon ever that successful, or is he living, is he, because there's nothing to really prove that his story about him being successful is true.
I mean, I suppose he talks about, like, the books or whatever. We can bust out the books and look at it, and I don't know if Kevin Spacey ever acknowledges that he was successful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he kind of does. He implies that he was successful by saying, look, you haven't been successful lately.
Yeah.
He really stresses lately.
But I also think that that could be read as him just, like, instead of trying to argue the facts, just being like, I don't care. Like, okay, whatever. Right. I don't care. What about now?
Mm-hmm.
You haven't sold shit for months.
Sure.
I don't know. But then again,
it,
it's
it
like...
is. So I feel bad for these guys, in the guys at the bottom of the stack. Like, you see Alan Arkin, whose character's name I don't even know.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he has $7,000 on the board, right? You get the impression that he's a below-average salesman,
mm-hmm,
who's just good enough not to be at the very bottom and to get by on his sales to live.
He's a single. He's a confirmed bachelor. He just eats microwave meals at home. All he needs is about $1,500 a month, and he's good.
Right. And I feel like that's a way you could go. You're not going to get to the top. You're not going to be Alec Baldwin, but...
Right.
You're gonna get by.
You're not gonna make $1 million last year, you son of a bitch.
Right.
What, man, it is crazy. I wish I didn't know. I wish I had an unfiltered reaction to his scene, because I'd seen it spoiled in pop culture so much that, because I feel like the audience, if you're in the movie theater and you're watching that, you're vacillating between Jack Lemmon's kind of disbelief and fear and Ed Harris's just open contempt. But every single time he tries, like, I thought Ed Harris made a couple good points, and Alec Baldwin just came back and crushed him every single time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, don't act like you don't want to be me, that you guys all want to be me, and this is what it takes to be successful, and I'm going to teach you this hard lesson, and if the losers can't take it, well, then get the fuck out.
Right. And I guess it's impossible to argue with success at some point, right?
Right.
Like, you can chuckle and you can laugh, but when a guy
say,
like that walks in,
yeah,
or and you he's can also, making $1 million a year,
you know, you can also say, like, well, I don't know how he sleeps at night. I bet he sleeps. I mean, that's the thing. Like,
sure, those guys don't,
yeah,
don't have a problem with what they're doing.
The guys
or they
that
wouldn't
are
be
successful
doing, it.
Doing this are not. I mean, yeah, they probably have what I would call terrible family lives, and their blood pressure's probably through the roof and all that. Right. But, like, I don't feel like they feel bad about it.
No, and you can see that. I don't know if it's budding in Al Pacino, in Roma, but you can see that same characteristic in Roma, right? Like, he doesn't care that what he's doing is sleazy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess none of these guys really do.
Right.
But some of them...
they bitch about it because, you know, they wish they had an easy sales job where they're actually selling stuff that people want, but, you know... And that's the other thing is like there's this really Darwinistic nature where they talk about the rich always getting richer. Like if you can master these high pressure sales tactics and make sales, then you get better leads because why would you squander good leads on your least effective salespeople? So like yeah, it's this thing where if you can't – if you fall on hard times, it's like the it's like the opposite of what most video games – like there's it's a modern trend in video games where you can have this brutally hard game that starts scaling back its difficulty if you fail over and over again. Mm-hmm. This – like being a salesman, it seems like the difficulty just ramps up as you meet failure because you have your own – like a lot of this is a mental and a mental toughness. Well, like – you know, the rejection starts wearing on you mentally. The desperation starts coming out. The desperation is the antithesis of these high-pressure sales deals. Like, they only work if the other person doesn't think that you're desperate. And then and you start getting weak leads. And
That's one of the ridiculous things about it. One of the indignities that I think David Mamet's trying to get at is this idea that, you know, guys, they put a foot on your face and climb up to the top because – as they're going up, you're going down because you're getting worse and worse leads. And it's not like you can just sell this stuff. I mean, if the lead is bad enough, if the lead is, you know, they use the example of the Patels in this who just want to talk to salespeople and can't, they won't buy if Vishnu himself comes
Vishnu
down.
And if Vishnu and Shiva came down with $1 million
and Shiva?
Yeah, Shiva and told him to buy this property, he still wouldn't. Buy. Yeah.
Right. So,
like, which is nice mix of racism thrown in there. But
There's a lot of slightly objectionable stuff in here, but maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But yeah, I mean, it's brutal because there is a cycle where you just can't get out of. It's like quicksand.
Right.
I don't know. And I can't even count the number of times they say leads in this movie.
Right.
It's maybe trumped only by the number of times they say fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, this is
it's like, all about the leads.
But it's like, you know, the guy that commissioned this, Eric, he talks about the rhythm and like it just reminded me a lot of like Deadwood. Mm-hmm. Which is a David Milch, I think that's the right one, production. Hmm. And he's known for that kind of lyrical obscenity as well.
It's actually our next commission.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. That's good, because you'll get to compare and contrast like this high-pressure, modern, Tarantino-style swearing versus the old-timey. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's still the same way. It's like it's very lyrical, and it just flows so well. It's like the Merovingian and the Matrix. It's just like wiping your ass with silk.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem as crude or crass as like, you know, your standard R-rated comedy, right?
Sure.
Like it feels real. Like this in this type of environment, this is how people really talk.
I mean, my God, as much as Alec Baldwin comes in and just delivers an iconic fuck you kind of speech.
Yeah.
Al Pacino does the same to Kevin Spacey when he ruins that deal.
Right.
Al Pacino eviscerates this guy.
Yes.
And it is glorious to watch.
Yeah. But the thing is it's weird because Kevin Spacey showed himself to be, his character showed himself to be kind of mentally strong because he pivoted from that withering attack where you just want to go home, cut your balls off, slit your wrist, and slip in the tub.
Uh-huh.
And like less than 5 minutes later, sees the opening in Shelley's armor and slides the dagger in there.
Right.
Which is further galling to Shelley because Shelley's just tried, he's rid on the Roma's coattails.
Just rub it in.
To jump it in. Like, I've got a little taste of success, and it's been a while, so I'm the one up, and you're the one down, and I'm just going to shit in your mouth.
Uh-huh.
And he fucks up and reveals that he was in Kevin Spacey's office, which must have meant that he had stolen the leads and all that.
It's so stupid of him of Jack Lemmon to do this, right?
Yeah.
Shelley should not be rubbing it in at this point because eventually he's going to be down again. And what do you expect this guy to remember
from this
encounter? That you made a big sale or that you rubbed it in his fucking face and told him to eat shit and die?
Right. I guess if you're Shelley, you're hoping that this display of dominance will put him off of fucking with you. Like, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's like, yeah, I might be down now, but do you really want to shovel shit at me? Because it's going to come back double when I get one up again. Like, that's the whole kind of, like, masculine posturing. It's baring your teeth and beating your chest and making this threat display so that you look like the not weak target to attack.
And the way he just...
it's no fun being office whipping boy. Like, they make fun of that, like, in Parks and Rec and stuff, and even, like, Silicon Valley. But that's a real phenomenon. There's always... Yeah. If you got... It doesn't... If you get more than three people working in an office together, someone's going to be the dumbass.
Yeah, I'd say so.
It seems like it. Like, you know... I mean, it's easy when you only have two people in the office because the other person's the dumbass. That's how we. It's always the other person fucking shit up. And if only they were like more like you.
But I can't believe how Jack Lemmon turns on a dime here. He makes one big sale, right? Like, which isn't actually a sale.
That's the thing. It's like
stupid to realize it.
He should have known. Like, he should have known that. And I wonder at some level if he did know that this was a horseshit sale, and that makes it kind of like even worse when he's going on and on and on and on about this. No, like even Kevin Spacey said, you should have known. Like, how deluded are you that you saw this and that you sat with these people and you saw? He says, like, the living conditions. Like, I'm imagining he's going to this dilapidated trailer,
right?
And he's making an $86,000 sale. Like, he knows that that's not going to stand up, but he wanted that success so bad that even though he knew it wasn't real success, he still... And that makes it even more deplorable that he was going to rub someone's face in this imagined success.
Right. And it makes me wonder what's going through Kevin Spacey. I think Williamson is his name.
Mm.
Kevin Spacey's head at that point. Like, because he knows. He clearly knows from the start that this is not a real sale.
Right.
But he's taking this abuse from Levine in this moment. And I don't know if it's because Al Pacino just eviscerated him and he deserves it.
Well, it's also a mirror of the earlier conversation where Jack Lemmon jumps in the car and just increasingly like, I thought that we might see, like, Jack Lemmon blowing Kevin Spacey. Like, that's kind of the desperation level, like, that I was feeling.
Which means that it makes perfect sense he steals the leads, right?
But Kevin Spacey, I felt like the whole time, never seriously considered selling these leads to him. He was just fucking...
He would have strung him along.
Yeah.
I want the money now. Oh, I want it in hundreds.
Right.
I don't want your 20s.
Or it'd be such a great one-sided deal that he could, you know, plausibly deny that it'd just be yet another thing that this loser Jack Lemmon is going to do to make himself a failure.
Right.
So I thought that's interesting the way he played it almost the exact same way. Because you're right. He had that hammer he could have flashed out at the very beginning of the conversation to shut Shelley down.
Yeah.
But he let him play, I guess, just to see what advantage he could extract from it.
And because he did deserve it a little bit, I think.
I guess, yeah.
You know, it is a mistake. Because
Roma did just completely rip his nutsack off.
For good reason.
Right. Well, I mean...
well, in that scenario, for good reason.
You should have known not to spoil my lie! I've been working this lie.
You should have known not to create your own lie before you know the shot. Like, well, he says, I mean,
and like Shelley,
find out
Shelley's
enough
a good enough sales guy that he knows.
Right.
And like, that's the other thing. Like he that's the other interesting thing is that he's got to know at some level he failed with these Nyquists or whatever the hell their name was.
Nyborgs. Yeah.
The Nyborgs. which what the hell kind
it's
of
a weird
name?
But,
like that feels like a couch I bought at IKEA. The Nyborg.
Maybe
it's got pocket holders in the armrests. It's made from recyclable bamboo. But he did have a genuine flash of genius when he was able to support Roma. And Roma giving him, like, you know, over-the-top praise and credit for that. So, pumped him up enough that he slit his own throat with Kevin Spacey's character.
Right. So that's interesting to me. The way... So I'm assuming that Roma knows that these people are not actually viable sales material, these Nyborgs, right?
Probably.
Like, I think Roma is smart enough to know that. He clearly knows these old leads.
Right.
He's been on all these calls before. So when he's pumping up Jack Lemmon, when he's saying, oh, great job, buddy, like, tell me the story, I feel like he is genuinely supporting the other salesmen in the office so that they can all kind of get ahead. And he sees a guy that's down on his luck, a guy that mentored him, apparently.
Right.
And he's trying to not shit all over him.
Sure.
Unlike Kevin Spacey, who's going to tell him to his face it's not a real sale.
Right.
So it's interesting the different way that he treats Jack Lemmon's sale versus Kevin Spacey.
Right.
The way he treats it. And it gives him the confidence to be his backup also when he needs it. Like you were saying, the vice president of whatever it is, American Express or something.
Right.
I feel like Roma understands the dynamics of these office of this particular office way better than anyone else.
Right.
And that's why he's so successful. He understands sales. He understands the office. He just understands how to maneuver in these waters.
I agree. And he's got, like, you can see him as a proto, or like a Baldwin on the rise, or maybe,
yeah,
maybe you get the feeling that he's almost a Baldwin's level, but he's just like, if he was a tad bit younger or better looking, that he would have gotten there, but maybe he's already at his peak and maybe he's ready to fall off. Because that's the thing, like,
maybe,
you know, I feel like a lot of this sales is so attractive. It's so interesting because, like, I was talking to some sales guy and he was in a pharmaceutical rep, and he was bitching about how that his industry is dominated by young blonde 20 somethings.
Right.
Which makes perfect
female
sense.
Female 20 somethings.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's funny because I dated a young female 20 something pharmaceutical rep, and she was just tripping over fat stacks because stereotypically these doctor's offices are staffed by older,
right,
wealthy men who, like, even if they're not going to cheat on their wives, they like the attention and they like the flattery. And even
of
if
course,
you're, yeah. I'm not saying that she was even unprofessional, but like that's, you know, attractiveness is one of the foundational privileges that we have.
Right.
And that's, as a salesperson, like, that's kind of scary because just like a model, you have a shelf life. If you're start losing your hair, or you gain a little bit of weight, or you're that aura of, I want to be this guy, I want this guy to like me, gets punctured just even a little bit, you're done. Mm-hmm. You didn't lose a step. And then I guess it's kind of like being an athlete too. Like, eventually your body's going to betray you, and you cannot run with the young men, no matter how much smarter or better physical or skill you are than them.
Right.
And I feel like that maybe that's Roma. Like, he didn't get the achieve escape velocity, and his best years are behind him.
It could be.
And he's moving off the Carlito's way, and it's never going to happen for
him.
He's
in an office full of losers, right?
Yeah, he's the win.
He's not with the closers. He may be a closer himself, but he's not with the closers.
He hasn't made it down to downtown.
Right. It indicates that maybe he's not quite as successful as, or never will be quite as successful as Alec Baldwin.
Right, right.
Whose character name I also don't know.
Right.
And I feel it's unnecessary to know.
He might not even say it because he says, what's your name? Fuck you, that's my name.
Yeah. He
God,
might just
so
be
great.
Alec Baldwin. He might be actually
It'd
playing.
Be hilarious if he's credited as fuck you. Fuck you as played by Alec Baldwin.
I read somewhere that his name was like Blake or something. Like, it starts with a B. I can't remember.
Because Kevin Spacey might have introduced him at one point. But
maybe.
Again, this is the first time I've seen this entire movie. But it's great. I also thought, like, the movie, like, there was a lot of, you know, I'd seen this thing, so I appreciated it, some of the comedy, just the fact that you're coming in and you're just treating these men like they're less than children, and there's nothing they can do about it, because if they say, I'm not going to put up with this shit, well, then fine, you're fired.
Yeah, don't and like it. Hit the bricks,
hit
pal.
Hit the bricks, pal. You want to be a good father? Fuck you. Go home to your kids.
It's just a glorious speech. Fantastic writing.
But I thought the Ed Harris and Arkin stuff, where he's trying, like, they're doing this duel where, like, Arkin's dumb, but he's not dumb enough to be, because Ed
Harris.
Are you
talking about the part where, are we talking about this, or
are
we just talking
about this? Are we talking about this?
Right.
And he's like, well, you know, obviously I'm the one that's a suspect, and I got an ironclad alibi, so obviously you have to be the one to steal it.
Yeah.
And Alan Arkin's like, I ain't going to do that, Ed, or whatever the guy's name is. And it just went, it's like this extended whose line is it, or who's on first situation that I thought was hysterical.
I did, too. I think there is some genuine comedy in here.
Right.
And that's the other thing about that Alec Baldwin speech is, every time you think he's done, he launches into the next stage of it. And it just builds on itself.
And at some point, like, you think he's going to do the drill sergeant thing where he's torn these guys down. And you kept on feeling like he's about to turn a corner where he's going to now give them something. And he kind of does. But he never really takes his foot off the fuck you, pal, you're losers.
Yeah.
Because then at the end, like, right when you think that he's going to be something kind of gently, he's like, just to answer your question, the reason I'm down here with you, these losers, is because your bosses told me to come down here to try to tell you something to give you kicking ass. My advice was just go ahead and fire you all.
Right, fire your fucking asses.
Right. And it's just like, oh, man. So
I don't know if they did this with a cut or what, but the way that Alec Baldwin effortlessly, I don't know if he has a hook in his briefcase or whatever, but
the brass balls.
Effortlessly just, they're not moving when he comes from behind that case.
Yeah.
Like, they're just there. Like, they were affixed to him.
Right.
And it is.
It's like stage magic.
Just.
There's
and,
his brass
and I gotta
balls.
give it up for the director too, because that shot is amazing.
Yeah,
just the pan shot.
How many hours did it take to perfectly frame Alec Baldwin's crotch?
Right. And just leave it there. Just leave it there while
he's
talking.
Have the confidence. Just film a man's junk while he's got brass balls hanging in front of him.
Yeah. No, it's iconic. There are several iconic speeches in this.
The other thing I always thought was interesting was this idea, like, you've heard a lot of this. Like, I know that I think the guy who runs GE, Jack Thompson or whatever, was famous for, like, every year firing the bottom 10% of his employees.
Oh, shit. Are we going to do that?
We need 10 first, so we can every year we'll call it the decimation. But here's the thing, like, going back to our Jehovah's Witness culture, if you remember, we had to turn in our time, how much field service we did every month, right?
Right, yeah.
And what you were graded by was the national average. Like, if the average publisher is getting 9.8 hours, then you were seen as, like, there's intense pressure to meet or try to exceed that.
Right.
There's a problem with this mathematically.
Inherent problem, yep.
If everyone is trying to meet or exceed an average quota, the average quota keeps creeping up into infinity.
Absolutely, yep.
That's like a mathematical, and like I always thought, like I tried to explain to some elders the difficulty of, like, if you
the
do realize.
The impossibility of
it. You do realize, yeah. Well, no, there. If everyone got like 10 hours a month,
right,
then everyone could meet the average. But that's if you have
but
any,
if
any,
but if people
even
start
one
going
person,
over, yeah,
yes. And I'm trying to explain. I felt like a crazy person, but that's kind of like this way the sales and, like, you know, GE was run as a company. Like, it's so weird because, like, well, get rid of the bottom 10% to make room for others. Well, what if you hire someone worse?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they go out with the next 10%.
You need reliable role players. You need the guy that's getting a consistent $7,000 a month. That's like, I just
right.
So
the problem becomes like. When you've weeded out all of the bad people and all you have is the cream of the crop, well, now
you're
weed
going to
out those 10%
start...
at the bottom, and now you're hiring people who are probably going to be worse,
yes,
because they haven't been through that process.
That's such a horseshit management style, and I don't understand why people don't. Like, I understand, like, you need to fire people, but on some arbitrary mathematical principle, it seems like madness.
Well, here's the interesting part of it. Mm-hmm. The top 90% of your staff
right
will always be the most amazing people you could possibly have, right?
Sure.
Whereas the bottom 10% are going to be whatever,
right?
So I mean, maybe it does work out,
but even if you have a team of superheroes, like, you mm-hmm. know, like you, like Aquaman is the one getting the cut out of Super Friends,
right?
He can still, like, you
but you don't need Aquaman. So let's say you fire Aquaman, right? And then for your new hires, you hire John Spolsky off the street.
Can he talk to whales? Can he swim super fast underwater?
No.
Well, then
now
he's
gone.
Aquaman.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing you've done
uh-huh.
is you've cemented the rest of the Justice League up there, right?
Right.
In the 90%. So they're never going anywhere. They're amazing. They're all awesome. But those bottom 10% are just going to keep rotating out.
Yeah.
Until you find somebody who is genuinely better than someone in the 90%, mm-hmm. they creep up into the 90, and now Batman's gone.
Yeah,
right?
Like, yeah.
Fuck you, Batman. We don't need
and
you.
And also, real talk, you could just fire everyone, keep Superman. Like,
that's
you
true.
Know,
yeah.
if the Justice League was run by a ruthless individual, they'd realize
but,
that.
But maybe you have to have two people, one person in the same place or in two different places at the same time.
All right, so you keep Captain Marvel. And maybe it may be Wonder Woman, so that she for vacation rotation.
Right.
But everybody else, like smartest man in the world, get the fuck out of here. Superman can shove a planet into the sun. You don't need anybody but him.
But I don't know. I think that bottom 10% is ruthless, but maybe effective.
I think. Well, I don't know. It depends on what the other thing is. It also depends on what kind of atmosphere you want in your company.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It also depends on
you don't want
how long you've been
doing
it.
The
like
culture.
To me, it's like that's just it's yet another way to have management be lazy. It's actually hard. The hard work of management is firing people, helping people improve, and then when they refuse to improve or adapt to the changing businesses, is to get them on to the next one.
Right. The idea of
it's
guaranteed
super easy
firings.
To come up with some kind of fucking bullshit metric, draw a bright red line, and all you guys get pink slips. That's
sure.
That's,
mandatory firing seems not seems unnecessary.
Seems super entertaining, like in a very gladiatorial type of way. Like
Alec Baldwin would love this shit.
Sure, sure. You can, like, you know,
jobs are for closers.
Yeah, I mean. I don't know. You could take the bottom 10% and then have them do a fist fight, and whoever wins the fist fight, you get to stay on another year. Like, there's all kinds of things you could do that might be even effective, but I don't know.
It's how Tyrell would have run E-Corp. The IT department would
have
just been.
You have to beat up at least five homeless guys.
Fights.
Here's your quota.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So I do have a question here for you.
All right. Because there's a whole other thing that Eric wanted us to go through that I thought would be entertaining if we did this and evaluated Bald Move based on this the lessons from this movie.
Okay.
So the wrap up, and maybe we have some other comments, but he sent in this article that was from some website that now I'm having a hard time remembering where it's from. Shit. ChristopherWink.com. I don't know who Christopher Wink is. I tried to find out, but he's got one of these new age horseshit websites that are just endless streams of content. You can't scroll to the bottom. I couldn't find an about section. So it's Christopher Wink, and he does a lot of stuff on sales and marketing. It's his blog, ChristopherWink.com. And he watched this movie, is impressed, and he came away with 10 life lessons that one can learn from Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, God.
I thought it'd be interesting to go through these and see, like, grade Bald Move on how well we meet the GGR standard. Point number one, a man is his job, says Shelley Levine, played by Jack Lemmon. Even if you don't define yourself by your work, the very fact of choosing work that allows you to not be defined by it makes it a part of who you are. What we do, what we spend most of our time doing, surely says a great deal about who we are. So, we watch television and movies and talk about it. What does that say about us, Jim? Are we I feel like that we're professional heisters at this point.
Professional slackers. Yeah, no, it's... I mean, it says that, hey, we like to watch TV. And we're into talking about it.
So, the other thing is, do you genuinely like watching television? I feel like we accidentally stumbled onto this because it just so happened as a golden age of television, you got into one or two shows. But I don't think you watch, like, you don't consider watching television and movies as, like, your core hobby.
No. Well, I mean, movies more so. Like, I was definitely more into movies at the time we started this.
Uh-huh.
Since then, I've gotten a lot more into television. And I think television has gotten better. But, yeah, I mean, before we started any of this stuff, I watched Lost religiously.
That's true.
There were a couple of shows that I really loved Firefly, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That kind of stuff. But yeah, for the most part, I would say I was more of a movie guy than a TV guy.
Point two, it takes brass balls to sell. The effort, confidence, and savvy to sell damn near anything is an admirable but enviable and often loathsome toolkit. Bald Move sucks at selling.
Yeah.
We essentially
we're the Ricky Roma of sales. You know, we don't want to push
you. We're forging a personal relationship with the listener, and then like, oh, by the way, I got this opportunity.
Yeah, it's called Club Bald Move. There's a club,
but it's,
you know, you gotta ask yourself what you would want to think of yourself in the morning.
Right. we give away that, like, regardless of whether you support us or not, you get the core product.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Eric's the one who purchases the podcast, but we're giving away to everybody.
Right. But there's an opportunity there if you really want to seize it.
Right. You could have us watch Death of the Salesman and compare and contrast. Or what's that one that had William H. Macy where he's going door-to-door selling vacuum sweepers?
Because
I feel like Death of the Salesman, this and that would be some kind of interesting trilogy.
I mean, William H. Macy does that in every movie, right? Fargo.
He's a really shitty salesman. But he's like persevere. Like, it's like, you know, like literal door in the foot kind of, or foot in the door kind of salesmanship there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we often remark, and that's like definitely one of our weak spots. Like, if we had anyone that could sell and market maybe, because we've been blessed by having like the best thing you can do for marketing. We can count on good positioning on iTunes because we were successful and we got lucky. But sales, like, I feel like, you know, if we had anyone that knew how to sell shit, we could sell a lot more ads, which would in turn make the club more attractive. And
not necessarily like sales to our customers who are,
no,
you know, club members. But
the only thing we do smart, I think, is because we realize that repetition is the key. Like, it took a year or two of getting the Amazon link out before that snowballed into something. It took a year or two of putting the club in people's faces before that kind of snowballed.
Let me ask you this.
But we don't have anything, like, I don't think we have any really technique other than asking people, hey, do you think this is worth it? Then support it. If not, hey, that's cool. We like you anyway.
Do you think that applies to the old leads? Do you think eventually persistence is enough to sell these old leads?
It just depends. If they're living in a creaky trailer and they're crazy, then no.
Right. But for the vast majority, I mean, those seem to be the exceptions among the old leads.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, like, we did a poll, like, a year and a half ago, and, like, something like 40% of the audience, and these are the ones motivated enough to help us by filling out a survey, are just like, hey, no offense, I'm never going to pay for a podcast.
Right.
The concept of paying
They're
for podcasts
the Patels.
Is like paying for oxygen.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I could do it, but I don't see
if
any...
If Mark Maron himself gave you $1 million to sign up for a podcasting club,
right,
they wouldn't do it.
Right, right. Yeah, it'd be Mark Maron and, God damn it, Joe Rogan.
Right.
Came down, gave you $1 million, said bald move is
and
the
a
thing.
Year's supply of on it, of brain drugs. What are the bells called? Shaped like a monkey face. What is his thing?
Shaped like a monkey face.
Yeah, the kettlebells shaped like a
okay.
a monkey's face.
Got you. I thought you were talking about Joe Rogan's like podcast logo.
No,
like
no.
that's you know, sure he looks like a monkey with a third eye, but that's kind of cruel. Point to third, ABC, always be closing. These immortal words from Baldwin's character are very nearly cartoonish in the movie, but the sentiment is real. Before entering any meeting,
sure.
Know what your ask is, what is considered a success. How could we apply that? I feel like every time we say something funny or we laugh, we should just be like, hey, if you laughed at that, you owe us $1, you fucker. You sons of bitches.
Right. Just have an insert.
Podcast whores. If you just laughed in your car right now, you owe us $1.
That's pretty good.
I think we should do it. I can't even remember the funniest, because like that's the other thing. It's like we often remark, like, man, if we made T-shirts from like just one funny concept that comes out of every season of television, our merch sales would be super successful. But that requires us, you know. I as soon as I get done finished recording a podcast, I like just clean it out of my memory.
I have to. We record so much that if I tried to keep anything in my head, it would just be I'd end up at the
like I retain
farm.
Plot in the universe, but like the running gags and stuff, that shit happens organically.
Yeah.
Four, you've never even been on a sit.
Let me ask you this before we move on to four.
Yep.
Always be closing. Uh-huh. It's so iconic, and Alec Baldwin does such a hell of a job delivering those lines. I felt like the AIDA stuff kind of got in the way. I know that's like real marketing shit,
right?
And it's principles of marketing, but I felt like they didn't need it.
No, I think we're supposed to understand that this is supposed to be a sales like informational seminar,
mm-hmm.
and he has taken the it's almost like everyone knows this. If you've been to any seminar, you've been to them all, this is the shit. I'm going to give it zero lip service. It's just there so I can say that I did it. Like,
right.
I kind of think that might be the point. I see
Maybe
what you're saying.
Is. Maybe it is.
But it's like, you know, he really was there to call them all losers, saying that you're going to be fired. I expect you all to be fired. This is a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like this weirdly motivational, but maybe you'll surprise me. I don't know.
Right.
Get enough fire in your belly. You never been on a sit, says Lemon's character, accusing Kevin Spacey's bookish character of being unaware of the real challenges of the sales. Two things in this point. One, there's a clear sense that any entrepreneur, any red-blooded American really should have some sales experience. I feel that. I don't. But I feel like that, you know, of the things it takes to be successful, being a showmanship and sales are one of the more crucial things.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather have a mediocre idea and a strong salesman than a great idea and no sales. Because honestly, we got lucky.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. What I'd rather have is a great idea and a lot of money to pay for exposure.
Okay.
Well, how would, that would really
but
work.
But that's
well.
The thing. Like, I feel like if we had $1 million ad budget, we would piss it up a rope and not know how to measure its success and not know
but
how
you,
to target
yeah.
it.
I mean, I guess you hire somebody who is a salesman who
at that point,
can
sure.
do marketing for you, right?
But if you didn't, if you were a salesman, you wouldn't need to.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, I mean, we got one or the other, like us both being technologically inclined.
Right.
Because, you know, having an internet business, that's super important. That if we had to hire out every single time we did a new initiative or project or something, we'd have gone broke. We'd never been able to do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
being
we did
able to
have
do, like basic art stuff.
Right.
Like designing shirts and logos. And
I think it's interesting when you got a guy like Steve Jobs who is a visionary. He's got the vision, he's got the ideas, he's got the leadership, he's got the salesmanship, and he's got just enough technical savvy to keep the engineers honest.
Right.
Like, once in a generation you get someone that rolls down the assembly line like that and they fucking take over the world.
How could they not?
Right.
I mean, and they're insanely driven. Like,
sure. Yeah.
Come on.
Right. they leave a lot of human wreckage in their wake, but they do a lot of great things.
Yeah.
5, appearances matter. This is, of course, nothing new, but the movie's humor comes best when the real estate agent characters are deploying any mechanism of treachery to fool their potential clients into believing any number of lies.
Yeah, Jack Lemmon, his desperation.
Right.
And the way he talks on the phone, I'm like, that can't possibly work on anyone.
Yeah. Grace, could you buy me a ticket? Get this ticket to Florida so I just, yeah,
$10,000 in cash
first class. Like, what?
Get out of here.
Yeah, like, you know, the only one that's going to fall for that are just rubes or morons. Lies are ultimately bad for business, but the point is clear. In most cases, you are who you present yourself as. You probably do good work and know your industry well, but do you look like you do? How does that apply to Bald Move? Because we've always portrayed ourselves as rubes from the hills of Indiana.
I mean, we're 100% honest with our portrayal of ourselves, right?
Right.
We don't pretend to be a big company that's producing, you know. So I see a lot of like one-man operations who throw up a website that says, that makes it look like they're a 100-person operation.
Well, like let's talk about the professional podcasters that we know.
Okay.
Like, there's a couple successful ones. There's a whole bunch of people trying to do what they're doing. But, like, I feel like when I see them talk on the groups, like, their struggles and the stuff that they're trying to do and the weird kind of cons they're running, I can't relate to any of that.
Oh, right. Like, how do I game the system to get into the top iTunes category?
Sure.
Like, to the top of my iTunes category.
Sure.
I'll tell you how to game the system. Make a great podcast.
Sure.
There,
and then,
boom.
And then hope to get it. That, but then rely on luck to get exposure.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, that's it's funny because, you know, in about 3 weeks, we are supposed to give us talk on how to be, you know, how to succeed at podcasting, and we'll see how it goes.
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess do good work and know your industry, but you look like you do. I guess. Like, I don't even know what that means in our context. You know, we could be in our pajamas, and I never shave, and...
Right.
I do bathe every day. That's a plus. But I guess like we have a website that looks like it's got a lot of interesting things on it.
Yeah,
it does.
I mean, in a lot of ways, like some of our product is honesty, right? Like we're not trying to fake you out and make you think that we're better or worse or different than we are.
Right.
We're just trying to put ourselves out there, and people. I think that's what sells people a lot of the time.
Which segues to point number 6, tell a story, get familiar, speak with passion, lying or not, succeeding or not, even these small-time real estate agents are always doing these 3 things. 1, they have a story to tell for why they're selling, what they're selling is the right fit and why now is the right time. 2, they're developing and remembering names and details to develop a connection and making that no even a touch harder. And 3, they're speaking like they're talking about what they're talking about matters. Mm-hmm. I feel like because of our core principles of honesty and transparency and, you know, the idea that we're not critics so much as we're fellow fans allows us to tell those stories, to be familiar to people and speak with and have that passion.
Right. Right.
That's the first thing I feel like, okay, well, Bald Move. Yeah, that's us in spades. 7, here's another good one. Have a deadline, always have a deadline. In the movie, every character is always leaving, so yes, we need to make the deal now. It's all hogwash, and the lying isn't necessary, but understanding that without a deadline of some kind, getting the movement you want is always going to be harder is paramount.
Yeah, it's part of that closing.
Closing. That's, I guess, the key to Bald Move's success is that we're both, I think, slacker/procrastinators by nature,
mm-hmm.
and the relentless grind of, like, every Sunday night this show is going to be on, and we have to talk about it every Tuesday.
Right.
Like, it's the magic formula of keeping us on this grind that continues to make the product that we need to do to be successful. Like, if it was up to us,
right?
You know, I'm trying to think of how, like, maybe if we got screeners, that'd be the worst thing to ever happen to us. Because then, like, HBO's like, here's these 10 episodes, watch it, and then record the podcasts. And what, like, we talk about how that would help us, like, set our schedule so much better. But I'm also thinking, like, it wouldn't surprise me if we waited till the very last minute to watch that and actually made an inferior podcast.
Maybe so.
That's my worst fear.
So. Yeah.
We'd get these and like we'd put them off, and then like, you know, now we got, oh God, we got to record 3 of these in one day. Jesus, we're just going to half-ass the whole thing.
I don't want to sell ourselves too short because we did have a long-running podcast before this where we hit our deadline hell or high water every single week for 77 weeks.
That's true.
So, I mean, I don't want to say we wouldn't do it. That's but always, it is more likely.
It's certain my fear
that we wouldn't do it,
and I feel like a lot of my success is fear driven too.
Yeah,
like I'm afraid let
of being
people
destitute
down.
And
I'm
homeless.
Yeah, sure. I'm afraid of what would happen if we didn't make a deadline. Like I'm trying to think if there's. I know that Cecily and I failed to because we decided to do two shows instead of one, and so the first show we had to do like a day or two later than normal. But like I can't think of any time that we've missed an actual. You know, we've never not done a podcast. I can't even think of one that we've done more than a couple hours later than normal either.
Right.
So
I guess the closest thing is these commission podcasts. We occasionally have to push those and it feels like a fairly easy thing to do.
Right.
Because we don't have a set schedule.
But I feel a pressure release. Like, yes, you can push one out a week, but if I put then it's like double pressure to get one next week and maybe even two.
Mm-hmm.
We're very deadline driven. I think that's a lot of our success. And that's the thing. It's unfortunate. I see a lot of podcasters like just the other week in one of these professional podcast groups that we're a member of. One guy was essentially saying, is it okay to slip a deadline?
Right.
And people were on there like, of course, you know, everything comes. And I'm like, if you want to be successful, it's super crucial not. Because it's not just that. It's not just the one time, you know, that you ring the dinner bell and the people come and there's no dinner. It's what that does psychologically. Like every time you do it, it's going to get easier. Like every time when you lie to someone, the next time you lie, it's going to be easier. When you miss a deadline, the pressure to miss the next deadline is not going to be nearly as much. You get habituated to any kind of negative stimulus.
Sure.
So I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
So these are guys who are acclimated to lying. These salesmen and they're willing.
I would say
willing
would
and
say.
Almost even eager to lie to people.
Yeah. Like they're social hackers. They're like a Mr. Robot. They're looking for ways to
that's true.
Manipulate people's loyalty and affection for their own ends. 8, make people explain themselves. This fits.
And can I make it clear? I'm not talking about all salesmen here. I don't think all salesmen are evil.
I don't think all salesmen are shitty.
I think I'm talking about these particular salesmen in this movie.
Yeah, I think that I've had great relationships with salesmen. Like my financial advisor is a sales guy, and he's awesome. Like.
Right.
I feel like he has given me such rock solid advice the last few years and even said like when after he looked at my financial package, like, look, it's not appropriate for me to try to sell you. I think you need these things. Mm-hmm. But when your financial situation, it would be counterproductive.
He wants to sell you 14 cars.
Yeah.
Instead of
I think he wants to bald move turns into a $1 million industry. Then I mean, that's smart.
Shame on the whatever. Whatever the expression is that he's going to be barking up the wrong tree on that.
But do you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like he's in the long
jokes on him. That's
jokes
the one
on
I'm
him.
Looking for.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Jesus.
But yeah, like, you know, he's built this relationship with an entrepreneur that's had a couple different companies. And like, if I ever hit it big, then and also, you know, I'm a kind of probably a low burner time investment for him. So I don't know.
Oh,
sure. I just think that I had a car salesman that I always went to back in Indianapolis because, you know, it was I felt like it was a fair and equitable and they didn't lie to me. Like I feel like that's definitely I've had great relationships with salespeople that do serve the customer. These are not, you know.
Right. These are not them.
And honestly, if I'm talking about a situation you're in, I just feel sorry for you because it sucks. It seems like it just must suck. Unless you're super successful and then, you know, you're Wolf of Wall Street.
The idea of working in like a call center, which is kind of the way that a lot of people get into this kind of stuff, just seemed like the worst to me. I absolutely would have hated doing outbound calls for sales.
I've also heard like, you know, like the GameStop employees that like got into it because they like to talk to people about games and are passionate about it. And then suddenly they have a quota for how many power up cards you can sell.
Right.
And like, oh, Jesus, you just turned this job that I liked into something that's living hell.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting. Number 8, I don't get. It's make people explain themselves. We too often bail on each other or simply misunderstand each other when we impatiently finish people's sentences or thoughts, when rather it's better to wait someone out. In sales, a sense of directionless from someone else is an opportunity to create direction for you both. Details are like family. You love them, but don't always need them to be around. Bring them up when they're beneficial or focus on the overall meaning or broad vision otherwise.
Yeah, I don't know about that point. That's a little weird to me.
Yeah.
I think he's getting at, like, Kevin Spacey jumping in and trying to make something up. And But I... details being, like, your family. No fucking clue what that means.
Yeah, right. Nine, ownership of the upper hand goes round and round. Throughout the movie, the cast of characters is always attacking someone else, only to find that vitriol coming back hours later. It was a combative, competitive work environment of one-upmanship. It didn't seem like any of the characters were aware that they would surely be in a different situation soon. That's a lesson everyone should remember. Give help because you're surely going to need it soon.
Right. I talked about that with regard to Jack Lemmon.
Right.
Rubbing it in Kevin Spacey's face. Right. Not a good idea, man. Next week.
And I've seen that, like, in my own career. Like, there's this memorable time where I questioned another team's lead. Not questioned, like, called him out, but I sent him a private email, like, hey, I just noticed in this latest build that there's something wrong with the, like, security sign-on thing, that it's not compatible. And he sent me back this, like, super humiliating message, and he copied my boss and his boss and all these other guys on it and just called me on the carpet and berated me that I had the temerity to waste his time with this bullshit. And then it turned out I was right.
Duh.
And I'm like, I guess I've
did you
already
rub it in?
No, fuck no. Right. Because my organizing principle is I am imperfect and I'm going to fuck up, and I do not want anybody to grandstand and lord it over me. I don't ever want to be that guy that does something like that. And so that's always frustrating, because that's in the development world, you're dealing with people that are always in disbelief that their code could be the problem. Mm-hmm. I'm always the guy that, like, even if I'm pretty sure, I'm going to go back through and make sure.
Yeah.
Because I want to be the one to find a mistake and fix it. I don't want anyone else to be like, look at your dumbass code, you shit bird.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Hit the bricks, pal.
Hit the bricks, pal. You're fired. 10, never open your mouth unless you know what the shot is.
Yes.
Perhaps one of the better, less-known quotes in the movie, Pacino's character scolds Scacy for bluffing without knowing the context and screwing up a deal. Big takeaway for me is, while clearly lying is bad business, despite its common usage in the film, going hard on a sell, bluffing or not, is only the right bet when you've done your research. I do agree that, because that's always interesting when a salesperson, like, talks with me in a way that makes me feel like they've completely misunderstood me or what my needs are.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that the going back to the State Farm agent that I was talking to, like, I went to him to buy term life and he's buy and whole.
Uh-huh.
Even though he should, I mean, I don't expect him to remember a conversation he had with me 3 years prior where he was saying that's a stupid idea, but, like, you know, I don't know. Have you ever had that feeling where you talk
certainly.
To a salesperson and they seem to be listening to you, but then they offer a solution that just is not even going to come close to what you need or what you can afford?
Yeah.
And it's frustrating.
Right. And I think that's, you know, one of the things we do to apply this to Bald Move.
Yeah.
Is we kind of want to get the shot before we pull the trigger on a new podcast, right? We want to see... Now, we didn't do that with Westworld because we're kind of into it from the jump. But, like, for most podcasts, we wait a season. We see how people are enjoying the show.
Right.
Once we know the shot, then we jump in.
Right.
And we start our thing. So I feel like, you know, there are lessons to be learned there. And that's one of the principles I like the most. Like, I'm not saying I want to go out and lie to people. But the thing is, you need to understand what kind of scenario you're in before you react to it.
Right.
Yeah. That just seems to be good life advice.
Yeah, indeed. And that's it. I don't know if you had anything else you want to talk about this movie. Again, it's one of those things, one of those classics that everybody should see.
The star sheer amount of talent. Alone. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
Like, on both sides of the camera and in the script writing, just it's amazing dialogue delivered by professionals at the top of their game.
Yeah. And then it feels a little like, it's interesting, the jazzy soundtrack at the beginning. It feels very, like, salesman noir.
Oh, that's, yeah. As I was thinking, like, when those blue titles are coming and they're playing that, it felt like a cop movie.
Right. And the train goes by.
Sure.
And you're thinking gritty city.
Salesman noir is a great way to describe that.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what I felt like. It's like I'm sitting down to watch, you know, In the Heat of the Night or a Hill Street Blues or something like that.
Right.
So there you go. Glengarry Glen Ross. Pretty amazing movie. Lived up to the hype.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Eric Cunanan, for giving me the opportunity to finally put that notch in my belt. We appreciate it. As we've often said, the Commission podcasts are one of the better parts of our jobs at this point. because of delights like this, stuff that, you know, you either wanted to but you never quite got a chance, or delights that you had no idea, like the Pontypool from last week. Next week we're going to be doing Deadwood,
which I've never seen, but
I've seen the first two seasons.
I've heard it's good,
and I think I got to see exactly what they targeted for us to watch. Mm-hmm. And was that a community commission?
I can't remember.
We might actually have to do some legwork to see exactly what. I imagine it's going to be the first two or three episodes, but we'll see. I'm looking forward to that. Thanks again, Eric, for commissioning this podcast. If you would like to do what Eric did and commission your own podcast, have us watch any roughly two-ish hours of entertainment. It can be a TV show. It can be a movie. It can be a video game, and talk about it. You can go to baldmove.com/shop. Click on the film canister, and then there are a bunch of a la carte selections that you can chip in for $10 at a time. We call those community commissions, or you can actually just man up, get the brass balls required, or the brass labias required to step forward and commission a podcast. It takes courage and conviction. But if you don't, then I don't know, you get steak knives or something. I've lost the metaphor.
Third prize is you're fired.
Third prize is you have to listen to someone else's podcast. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye-bye.